Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Marvel Monday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a few Marvel books in detail. There will be spoilers, so you have been warned. If you haven't read these particular titles, you may want, and you plan on reading them, and you don't want them spoiled for you, you may want to come back after you've had a chance to check them out. So the books I'm going to be talking about here, Guardians of the Galaxy number one. This is the 2019 issue of Guardians of the Galaxy. I think there's been another one. This is the six-issue limited series that deals with Thanos' death. I'm also going to be talking about Immortal Hulk number 12. We'll cover Man Without Fear number 4 from Jed McKay. Superior Spider-Man number 2. And then from the Charles Soule run of Daredevil, issue number 19. So again, I'm going to get pretty spoilery here. So you've been warned. If you don't want to have things spoiled for you, you may want to come back at a later date. So let's go ahead and kick it off with Guardians of the Galaxy number one. In the interest of full disclosure, I've never been that interested in the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's probably one of my least favorite of the MCU movies, even though I haven't seen them all. Just didn't really do it for me. That being said, I kind of was a fan of the first Guardians of the Galaxy, which is, it's so interesting to when you talk about Guardians of the Galaxy, because the first iteration was, you know, far in the future with Vance Astro and all those guys. And then, you know, we came back to the present and they created like a precursor to them. So, I mean, when you think about the earliest ones being actually the latest team, it can be kind of confusing. But anyway, the Guardians that most people know obviously is from the MCU. So you're talking Groot, Rocket Raccoon, Gamora, obviously Star-Lord and Drax, you know, and that's that Dave Bautista tattooed version of Drax that I've gone on record as saying, I don't really care for the design. I don't really care for how dumb the character is. I much prefer the classic Drax, even though he's got the 70s pirate boots and the big giant purple collar and purple cape. But I don't know. That's just the classic one that does it for me. So I've never been a big fan of that group of individuals. That being said, I really enjoyed this issue and this series, and maybe it's because it ties in so much with Thanos. I'm not really sure, but I really, really dug it. So anyway, basically what happens is in the events of Infinity Wars, we saw Gamora get control of the Infinity. I think they're even in the Marvel Comics universe, they're called Infinity Stones now rather than Infinity Gems. But anyway, she gets a hold of those things. And she's able to supposedly finally kill Thanos. You know, she cuts off his head. So when this one starts, we're actually on one of Thanos' ships, one of his versions of Sanctuary. I don't even know what number he's up to anymore. 4, 5, 6, who knows? But it is that same kind of Thanos classic Sanctuary design that looks like an H. And we have a voiceover that's saying, hello, thank you all for being here. Let me begin by saying this. The galaxy is broken. 100 worlds at war, the stars run red across the black as ancient gods stir from the slumber. Never in my time have I seen such hatred and division among the various houses and tribes of the cosmos. Never have I seen such unmitigated death. The abyss is burning, ladies and gentlemen, and yet here we all are all together. Kree, Skull, Shi'ar, Asgardians, heralds, demons, pirates, kings, united for today. And what are they united in? Well, they're united in the fact that they're all bearing witness to the last will and testament of the mad titan Thanos. And it's Eros, it's Star Fox himself that's sort of giving this eulogy of Thanos being gone, Thanos being dead. But as happens with everything that deals with Thanos, it's not that simple, right? And so Eros plays this hologram of Thanos saying, hey, if you're seeing this, I'm dead, and or you know, been led to believe I'm dead, and you've been brought together to hear the final words of Thanos. But this is untrue. I'm not really gone, because basically what I did is I prepared for my death just the way Thanos prepares for everything. And what I've done is I set it up so that my consciousness would be uploaded and implanted into another mind in the case of my untimely demise. So Thanos immediately sowing paranoia among these cosmic beings of or cosmic characters of the Marvel Universe. Because as we look out among the gathered here that Eros is talking to, we see people like the Silver Surfer. We see the Shi'ar Imperial Guard. We see what's her name? Moondragon. We see so many of these characters that Cosmic Ghost Rider is there. Just so many of these characters that we kind of associate with the cosmic corner of the Marvel Universe. You know, the Corsair and the Starjammers, Darkhawk, who's become a cosmic character, Vance Astro, that I mentioned before, this version of Vance Astro that's in current time, Beta Ray Bill, Howard the Duck. I mean, just a lot of people that you associate, and I know Howard the Duck, right? Fee LaVelle. And so these certainly are the characters that you would, you know, associate with space or that sort of corner of the Marvel Universe. Who you don't see are any of the traditional Guardians of the Galaxy. None of them, you know, Gamora, Star-Lord, Groot, Drax, who am I forgetting? Gamora. We don't see any of those characters. And they're almost conspicuous in their absence. So anyway, after the message finishes playing, we see Firefox saying, well, you can see why I called everybody here, right? He says, all assembled, you're the greatest and most influential powers that exist in the known universe. But you'll also notice a distinct lack of the Earth's mightiest heroes, the Avengers, right? Of which Star Fox was a member. He said, well, because how should I say this? Those heroes are maybe kind of adverse to getting their hands dirty. And when it comes to the situation we're in, we may need to make the difficult decisions. And Fee LaVelle even says, well, what about the Guardians of the Galaxy? Where are they? I mean, they're certainly not averse to making tough decisions or living in that gray area. And then the scene shifts on the next page. Halfway to nowhere, we see Groot and Star-Lord. They're pretty much the only two remaining members of the Guardians at this point. And Groot's sort of he's evolved. You know, if you're only familiar with him from the movies, where the only thing he could say is "I am Groot," he's got a little more intelligence now, and he's whittling at himself and causing a bunch of sawdust or whatever you call it. At least that's what Peter Quill calls it. And he's getting annoyed because it's floating around in the you know, no gravity of their spaceship, and these guys they're on their way to nowhere. Which, if you're not familiar, it's a space station that is the head of a celestial, like a celestial that's dead and had his head cut off, and they've turned it into a space station. But when they get there to the location of nowhere, it's not there. And they're like, wait, what? Like, they were planning on docking and having some drinks and, you know, refueling, resupplying, and nowhere is not there. Meanwhile, back on Thanos' ship, Star Fox is saying, I'm afraid we're going to have to kill quite a lot of people. In the hopes that we kill the person that Thanos uploaded his consciousness into. Not exactly the best plan, in my opinion. Just go around killing people, thinking, well, these are the most likely that Thanos would have uploaded his consciousness into. I don't know. Like, maybe you want to try to figure it out some other way. But anyway, Beta Ray Bill says as much. Like, this is madness. We don't even know if Thanos is telling the truth. This could be part of some game, you know, from beyond the grave. Thanos is getting us to kill innocent people. And Silver Surfer says, well, it could be or it could not be, but I don't think that we can just ignore this. And the Gladiator, a member of the Shi'ar Imperial Guard, says, yes, that's true. You know, if we'd had the capacity to go kill Thanos as a child, think about all the people in the universe that would have been spared misery or death. And Cosmic Ghost Rider's like, man, I knew it. I knew I should have shot that damn baby in the face. Which is interesting because Donny Cates is writing this, you know, and he wrote the Cosmic Ghost Rider series where Cosmic Ghost Rider did basically team up with Baby Thanos. And I didn't finish reading that series, so I don't know, you know, all the details and how it all played out. Couldn't get past the first couple issues. Didn't interest me. But anyway, Eros is saying, okay, well, we've narrowed down the list to the likely candidates, highly likely candidates, and we need to figure out a way to discern if Thanos is any one of these people. And we might be able to get more information if we further dissect Thanos's body. If it were up to me, I would throw his corpse into the sun. But for now, we're going to have to start with the most obvious candidate, which is Gamora. And so she must die. And when we see the list of candidates here, I mean, some of them are straight up heroes. Some are not ones that would be so obvious. I don't know. I thought it was a strange choice of characters. I just don't see Thanos ever choosing Luke Cage or Daredevil or Kamala Khan as a vessel for his spirit. Deadpool also. Black Panther, eh. Nick Fury, eh. Loki is, it would be an interesting choice. I mean, I don't think that Thanos could really, he doesn't have that sense of mischief that Loki has. I don't think it'd fool a lot of people. Invisible Woman, again, I mean, she can be super, has a potential to be super powerful, but I mean, there are some that are way more obvious here. Obviously the Hulk, Namor, Mephisto, Iron Man, Odin, Juggernaut, She-Hulk, Gamora, obviously Jean Grey, Venom would be an interesting one as well. But yeah, for the most part, it's, I'd say about half of these characters, you just wonder. It just doesn't seem to make that much sense to me. But anyway, as they're having this discussion, and Star Fox basically says Gamora must die, Phyla Vell is pretty upset. She's like, I knew it. I wanted to kill that lunatic the first chance I had when Moondragon and I arrived in this insane universe. I mean, she's never gotten along with Gamora. And, you know, Gamora, she's, I wouldn't necessarily call her a hero, but I wouldn't necessarily call her a villain either, although her actions in Infinity War weren't the best and reflect that well on her. You know, Moondragon's not exactly on board, even though those two are obviously, you know, very close. And Phyla's like, look, Eros is right. After what Gamora did with the Infinity Stone, she's obviously the choice. And Moondragon's like, so wait, we're hunting people now based on their parents' actions? Although, you know, technically Gamora is not the biological daughter of Thanos. She is pretty much the closest thing he has to it. But, you know, I like what Moondragon says here. She's like, you know, we really need some evidence. Taking the word of Thanos is insane. Like, again, to echo Beta Ray Bill was saying, like, we don't even know that this is the truth. Thanos could just be playing us, basically. And that's something to really consider. And Frank Castle, Cosmic Ghost Rider, says, yeah, I kind of agree, right? You start walking down the path of this person could be Thanos, this person could be Thanos. He could be in this room with us right now. You know, Thanos coming to his own funeral, watching folks fight over whether what he's saying is true or not. That wouldn't be the craziest thing that we've ever seen. And before they can further their discussion, all of a sudden, Beta Ray Bill cries out, by the gods, look, and we see that Nowhere is there, firing this energy beam at the Sanctuary Thanos ship that they're on. You know, that decapitated, dead celestial head that had doubled as a space station. And it basically cracks one of the arms of the H off of the Sanctuary ship, and it fires these tentacles into the ship. Some of the heroes that we saw attending are immediately blown out in the decompression. And, you know, just the fact that the cables that are coming out of the mouth of Nowhere, the celestial head, are Corbinite steel. I mean, it's a celestial head, right? It's a dead head of this nearly cosmic god that can travel faster than the speed of light. These cables are unbreakable. We're told it could survive the heat death of a neutron star, and they're in trouble. So the people that weren't blown out immediately from the initial blast have been able to kind of sort of get their bearings, and Silver Surfer is trying to kind of rally them, saying, okay, everybody, you know, get on your feet. It's likely that this is a robbery, basically. Like, they're after Thanos' body. So, you know, let's regroup and let's prevent Thanos' body from falling into the wrong hands. Nobody gets to it. And so they start fighting. And before they can really establish any sort of stability or kind of, you know, mount a sufficient defense, the Black Order shows up. And the Black Order, they're the ones that are behind this. Obviously, Thanos's sort of personal guard, if you want to look at it that way, his generals, you know, however you want to say it. And so then the scene shifts back to the original location of Nowhere as a space station. And we see that Peter Quill is talking to somebody from the Nova Corps and basically reporting the fact that Nowhere is missing. And the Nova Corps is like, have you been drinking today? And he's like, no. He's like, well, are you still with the Guardians of the Galaxy? Where's your crew? And Star-Lord kind of gives him the rundown. Well, Drax is dead. Gamora's a villain, I guess. And Groot is here. And the Nova Corpsman's like, well, what about Rocket Raccoon? We don't talk about Rocket Raccoon. Well, what about your ship? Is it still the Milano? Nope, Milano's gone. New ship's registered as Ryder. Whoa, after Richard Ryder? You know, very, very famous member of the Nova Corps. No, Winona. He's like, what? Like, look, what are you going to do about this right now? Where's this Nowhere? Where's the station? And what are you guys doing about this? And right then, the Nova Corpsman gets a call, and he's like, hold, please. Well, actually, it looks like you might be onto something. We're picking up readings, a few light years outside of Marcus Centauri. Reading as a celestial, moving very fast. So I'm going to head out there because that's where the big meeting aboard Thanos' ship is supposed to be happening. And, you know, may have something to do with that. And Star-Lord's like, wait, what meeting? And Groot says, oh, yeah, we got invited to that. I forgot to tell you. He's like, Groot, what the hell, man? Come on. And he's like, we need to get over there. And then Nora Cosmo's like, nope, that's a negative. We have this under control. I'm sure it's fine. Not a big deal. Meanwhile, back on the ship, Sanctuary, the heroes are not faring well against the Black Order. They're you know, still reeling from the initial blast. And the Black Order are able to send some cables in, some grappling hooks, and grab onto Thanos' body and make their escape. And there's a few of the heroes that that try to follow them as they're making their escape, but they basically create a rift in space right there. It's basically just a hole in the fabric of space. Almost like a black hole, you could think of it as, in terms of it just sucks in everybody. So we see that as the rip begins to get bigger and bigger, the Black Order is successful in reeling in Thanos' body, and Nowhere just winks out, just like teleports away. And we see a few of the heroes that are sucked into this rip. We see Moondragon, Phyla Bell, we see Beta Ray Bill, Cosmic Ghost Rider, Silver Surfer, and it's almost closed. The rift starts collapsing, and just as it's about to close completely, we see Beta Ray Bill's hammer, Stormbreaker, come flying out and goes flying past all the Nova Corpsmen that have shown up, and they're like, well, what the heck's that? And the hammer has this chain wrapped around it. It's actually a chain of Cosmic Ghost Rider. And just so happens, right as Peter Quill and Groot are getting there, Stormbreaker goes crashing through the front of their ship and anchors onto it. And they're like, okay, Groot, grab and lock that chain. It looks like we just fell into a rescue mission. And he fires his engines, and he's able to rescue the people that got pulled into the fabric. Or the rip in the fabric of space. We see Beta Ray Bill holding onto the chain, and you know he's got Moondragon and Phyla Vell, Cosmic Ghost Rider. They're all holding on, and Stormlord's like, "Is that Beta Ray Bill? Is that even possible?" And yeah, the Moondragon, Phyla Vell, some weird demon guy. They refer to Cosmic Ghost Rider as. We don't see Silver Surfer though. And he definitely looked like he got sucked in. And as they're able to sort of recover from their ordeal here, Beta Ray Bill says, Corsair, the Star Jammers, Silver Surfer, the Imperial Guard, the Skrulls, they're all gone. And the Black Order has Thanos' body. We've failed. And Peter Quill's like, hold on, what's going on here? And the Nova Corps show up, at the back of the ship saying, you're going to have to hand them over to us. We have some questions. And Quill's like, I don't think so. Check your files again. You're going to need a warrant to enter my ship. And they're like, no, that's not how it works. The galactic rights only extend to members of your crew. And even then, only tentatively. He's like, oh, yeah, you didn't know? This is my new crew. They're with me. So apparently the new Guardians of the Galaxy are Moondragon, Cosmic Ghost Rider, Star-Lord, Beta Ray Bill, Groot, and Phyla Vell. And Cosmic Ghost Rider's like, wait, no. I don't remember signing up to be a member of any sort of damn Guardians of the Galaxy. Meanwhile, on the next page, we see that the Black Order have returned to whatever planet they're currently using as a home base with Thanos's head. And they kneel before somebody and they say, Thanos is yours again. And a voice from off panel says, the others, his brother, they're dead. Their bodies are scattered across time. So apparently that rip wasn't just in the fabric of space, but time as well. And whoever this is who off panel says, well, where's his head? Well, it was not on the ship. Well, go get it. He's got to be complete if we're to resurrect him. And the Black Order want to know, well, wait. Thanos is together with his greatest love right now, and you want to rip him away from her? That would be us basically taking on death herself. No one can defy her will, not even you. And then we get to the last page, and it says, not even Hela, goddess of death. So that's who's behind this, apparently, behind the Black Order, the new big wig that's pulling the strings of the Black Order. Why she wants to resurrect Thanos, what her plan ultimately is. I mean, she's sort of the Norse god of death, if you will. But that's not to say she's the embodiment of death itself, which, again, if Thanos is finally with his beloved, finally with death, why would he want to be resurrected? Why is he instilling his consciousness in another body? So it's pretty interesting. And what I like about this this start, not only is it really compelling and sucks you in right away, is the fact that what Cates is doing here, he's telling us a really new and fresh take on Guardians of the Galaxy. Who are the Guardians? Is it this group that just got together? Is it going to be somebody else? Are we going to see Gamora and Rocket and Drax come back? And the scenes with Quill and Groot, they definitely feel like the Guardians of the Galaxy that people have come to know from the MCU and previous Guardians of the Galaxy series with that particular team. But the rest of the book feels so different. It feels so much more serious than a regular Guardians book. So I like that that combination. So highly recommend the series. It's really, really off to a great start. All right, let's move on to the next book. Talk about Immortal Hulk number 12. This is from writer Al Ewing. We have art by a couple of guys because there's flashbacks in the story. So the main story, we have pencils by Joe Bennett and inks by Rui Jose. And then in the flashbacks, we have pencils and inks by Eric Wynn. Colors are by Paul Mounts. Letters are by Corey Petit. So this one starts off, remember that the Hulk had basically been sort of sucked down into hell is what we're led to believe. And it starts off with sort of some exposition from Al Ewing. And he's talking about what the devil is, and in modern culture, Daredevil's clearly defined. You know, he's supposed to be this sort of evil slanderer. He whispers in our ear, tempting us to do bad things, basically to sin, break the rules, and all evil, comes from him. He's kind of the root of it. And from an early age, we learn about the differences between things, the sort of opposite poles, if you will, day, night, rational, irrational, healer, destroyer. And, we learn about evil, we learn about good, but we also learn about God and we learn about Satan or the devil or, whatever you want to call it. And so you've got, God on one side who made everything and supposedly works for good, this mysterious Heavenly Father. And then you also have his opposite number, which would be obviously the devil, the monster who's against the Father, the one who breaks things apart, as it were. So we get this, a little bit of a philosophy lesson, I guess, or just kind of setting the stage for what Ewan is trying to do here. And then we get a flashback of Bruce Banner when he was a child and his father being very verbally abusive and to both him and his mother. Again, it's things that we know about Banner's father, how abusive he was. His father abused him and he's following in that same sort of legacy of abusing Bruce. And we see the effects it has on Bruce as a child and kind of stirs his anger. And then the scene shifts and we see the Devil Hulk in his body, but his body has been somewhat emaciated. We saw that in issue 10, where the Absorbing Man was able to take some of his energy, and he's in hell and he's fighting against this apparition or this being that he saw as the Red Hulk, and he's just smashing it over and over and over, and he's lost control to the point where he's not even the Devil Hulk anymore. And Tina McGee's, you know, trying to reach him, saying Hulk, Hulk, stop, and he's yelling, and you know, he's reverted to the kind of the Savage Hulk, you know, kill everything, Hulk smash, Hulk smash, not making any sense. And Tina's father is saying, look him in the eye, bring him back to us. And so Tina, actually, to her credit, super brave, reaches out and touches him, and it kind of shocks him back to reality. He stops punching, says, wait, Hulk smash? And she says, Hulk, listen, you need to stop, okay, big guy? Like, you need to chill out, basically. And we know that the Savage Hulk, you know, he's very childlike. And he says, you know, Hulk hurts all the time. Why do they always have to hurt Hulk so much? And he's got tears coming out of his eyes. And Big E's saying, you know, I don't know, but I'm sorry, but can I speak to the Devil Hulk? Can you let him out for me? And again, with the tears streaming down his eyes, the Savage Hulk says, okay. And switches. There we go. Just switches personality just that quick. And the Devil Hulk apologizes, saying, sorry, big guy, he mostly stays inside these days, but if I really lose it, well, you see what happens. And Tina's like, okay, well, I've got another question for you. How long have you been in charge? And he's like, in charge of what? She's like, no, don't play that game with me. We know Banner has DID, dissociative identity disorder. In fact, he's got the most established and famous case in the world. You're just one of multiple personalities. If you want to use that term, you're part of the system. But you seem to be running things these days. So how long? And he says, well, somebody had to, at least at nighttime. During the day, that's Banner time. And Tina says, well, it is daytime. Look, the sun's coming up. So where is he now? And Devil Hulk kind of looks around. He's like, you know what? I don't know, but I got a pretty strong hunch where he might be. So let's get moving. And then we get some more philosophy here. From Al Ewing, he's talking about Zoroaster, which is a religion, very ancient, and he's talking about some of the deities. If you want to talk about naming evil, Zoroaster has a deity called Angra Manu, which is supposed to be the chaotic spirit, the destructive mind, and it's defined as the opposite of good. And in their religion, you have the Aram Mazda, the Lord of Creation. And they're both the twin sons of Zervan, which is time itself. So time existed first and gave birth to these two twins, Angra Manu, which is evil embodiment, basically, and Aru Mazda, which is good and creation. And he talks about how long they've been around and how they sort of, when you take them together, it's this concept of the fall of man, like why man didn't work, what man is not deserving of paradise, right? So Angra Manu has in its power the ability to create, but he's refused to because the fact that he has a brother who is evil, right? He's birthed along with this chaotic spirit, this Angra Manu, right? He has the ability to create, but he's choosing not to, right? Aru Mazda, Lord of Creation, same powers, but he's chosen to be good. So you think of it as, you know, beings that have conscious thought. One is choosing to be good, one is choosing to be evil. And it's that idea that the world that we exist in, existence itself, is tainted. It's ruled by God's opposite, if you will. This chaotic God refuses to use his powers for good. Evil's actively chosen. And maybe that's what it means to be the devil, right? You actually make that choice. And so then the scene shifts and we see Bruce's father, or some, what appears to be Bruce's father. So it could be the embodiment of something else. And we see that he's got Bruce trapped in this basically green energy beam. And he's talking about how it wasn't his fault. He was a young man and, you know, he loved her mother very much. And can you understand what that was like to finally be loved? Because there was no love in the house that I grew up in. And I didn't want children because I didn't want to break the spell. I didn't want to hurt what we had. It was so full of love. And of course, you came along as a surprise and broke it anyway. But you know, at least I was loved and respected at work. Right. I was a rising star in the field of gamma research. And do you see how I knew what you were like right from the beginning? And then we get another flashback and, you know, kind of the origin, if you will, of Brian Banner, and where he starts to lose it. And he said he had a theory about gamma radiation, that there was a third form to it. You know, sometimes it acts as a wave, sometimes it acts as a particle, but there was this unknown third form. And I think this goes really well with the idea of good versus evil. You know, you have good on one side, you have evil on another, but what other choices there? What's the other point of the triangle? And Brian Banner took this to his department heads and they were kind of skeptical, but there was enough there in the hypothesis that he was allowed to pursue it. So he says he worked long hours, late into the night, over and over, trying to find something. And one of those times in the darkness, he was exhausted and searching for the secret. He closed his eyes and for a moment, he thought he saw something, that something that he had been searching for was searching for him. And the panel we get here from Joe Bennett, or actually, I think it must be from the other artist, because it's in the flashback part. So it's from Eric Wynn. And it looks just like this gossamer of green energy. But when Brian sees it, he knows that it's not something good, right? It scares him. And the look on his face is he's terrified. And he says, the next morning, I told the department head they were right. It was nonsense. I never did get back the respect they had for me. And I told myself it was a dream. It meant nothing. But what I'd seen, it stuck with me. It was this grotesque presence, like a glimpsing through a crack in the door, this nightmare cellar world underneath the floorboards of everything, you know. So we're kind of harkening back to what we talked about in issue 11 with the tree of life and the, you know, the existence of that highest point, which, where, you know, it's the pinnacle of goodness, what is right, what is good, what is just. Then there must be an opposite, you know, so something that's even below hell itself. That's kind of the pinnacle-ness or the embodiment of what is absolute evil, like the absolute worst, the lowest kind of basest existence, you know, the whatever the 180 degree opposite is of pure goodness and justice and everything, you know, it has that opposite. And so once he saw that, everything changed for him. It was that terrible eye that could always see him. And he wanted to talk to her, to Rebecca, about it, his wife. But that's the same night that he goes home, there's champagne laid out, and he finds out that Rebecca's pregnant, right? He says, I was damned. So he feels like his whole life fell apart in you know, such a quick period of time. He didn't want kids because he knew that he couldn't share the love of his wife. And, you know, on top of that, he's just basically had this crazy thing happened to him at work and lost the respect of his colleagues, knows he'll never get it back, probably doesn't know what his career will even be or amount to at this point. And he feels like he has this evil, this curse that's on him. So he says, yeah, you were born nine years later, difficult birth. Rebecca nearly died and it didn't matter. I'd been replaced because you took her love from me. You did that. and then you killed me at your mother's grave in cold blood. And well, no, that wasn't you. I have to remember that. It was the monster who cast me down to hell. And when I tried to protest the injustice of that, yeah, the monster killed me again and sent me even further down to the hell beneath hell. And that's where the thing from my dream was waiting for me, right? That thing I'd seen all those years ago. Creation's secret reflection is what he calls it. It's vaster than we can see or know. And it can only influence the world if it has a host. It needs somebody that it can speak and act through. And now it has me for that. But now it has you. Now it's captured you. And you're immortal, right? And you've been brought through it or brought through the door to it. The door that you tore open with the bomb, that gamma bomb that opened the green door. And now this, whatever it is, this embodiment of evil can be set free. I can be set free because it's going to be in you. And I won't have to worry about it. And then we get the kind of the captions return. It says there's another devil in the Old Testament, the book of Job. We see the first mention of the entity bearing the name Satan, meaning accuser or adversary, one of God's devils. And Satan's given permission to test Job, and that the test basically scours Job down to his very soul. And Job demands answers from God, like, why would you do this so much? And eventually God responds, but it's hard to understand. God doesn't speak in human terms. And the 19th century theosopher Anna Kingsford says that Satan is an angel of God. And in her writings, he's the sifter of souls, right? The accuser who brings judgment on those that fall short, right? He's the angel of wrath. And he's the one that guards the door. And he holds the power to cast people into hell, because he's the breaker of worlds, right? So, and as we are being told all this, we see Puck and the Abomination, who somehow have traveled to hell also. They're climbing up the side to the beam, that side of this hill or this mountain where Brian Banner's standing on top of, and the beam that's holding Bruce is there. And we see they're too late because there's this malevolent force that looks like it's coming down from the clouds. It's just got these two big green glowing eyes, and it's just this giant noxious looking cloud that looks like it's going to devour Bruce Banner. And Tina says, oh, we're too late. How can we fight that? It's the end. And Devil Hulk says, that creep, he's not the end of the world, Tina. She's like, how do you know? And he turns and looks at her with a big smile on his face. And he says, because that's who I am. And the issue ends. So we're getting into some heady stuff here. And as much as I like the story of Immortal Hulk, there's a little bit too many of these type of issues where it gets really sort of existential and a little too, I don't know what the right word is, like hoity-toity. Like you're overcomplicating things. And I don't think that most readers are going to enjoy. Like there's not even any action in this. You know, we do get the flashback that's informational and that's, you know, sort of gives us background into Bruce. But a lot of this stuff is ground that's been tread over before. You know, we know that Brian Banner was abusive to his son. We know how it set up the different personalities that Bruce deals with and all that sort of thing. But I don't know, all this talk of God and evil and the tree of life and the opposite of that, it's like, really? It just, I don't know. This book sometimes is so inconsistent, but it is always very different. And the artwork is always spectacular. So I don't know. I guess as much as I enjoy Immortal Hulk, I've said it before, it's not my favorite take on the Hulk. You know, I'd much rather have the Professor Hulk or Banner's in Control or the sort of childlike Hulk where Banner's on the run, you know, kind of inspired by the 70s TV show with Bill Bixby. Those are my favorite sorts of Hulk. This one, I don't know. It's body horror, and it's supposed to be spooky and weird, and it just, it doesn't always do it for me. Some of the issues I feel like, okay, we can move on. And this is certainly one of those issues. I mean, it's okay. Not great. You know, it's, I tend to read Immortal Hulk in big chunks, kind of like I do with The Walking Dead for exactly this reason, you know, because you read one issue and you don't get that much story sometimes, I feel like. So, all right, moving on. Next, I'm going to talk about Man Without Fear, number 4. This is written by Jed McKay. We have art by Paolo Villanella. Colors are by Andrew Smosa. Letters are by Clayton Cowell. So this is, I think, the only book in the weekly series that's not drawn by Danilo Bayruth. But the art is similar. It's not so different that I would think it would be really disruptive in the trade. And it starts off with Matt. He's still in the hospital. You know, we know he's recovering from being basically run over by a truck. And the Kingpin has come to visit him. And Matt's aware that he's there. He's like, I don't have my eyes open. I don't need to have them open to see him. I can sense him. And he's as big as a mountain, big as the whole damn world. And he's here in my room. And all I can do is pretend to sleep and listen to my own pulse, you know, jackhammering in my ears. It's Wilson Fisk, the Kingpin of crime. And I've never been so afraid of him as now. And Kingpin's sort of there to gloat. He's like, look at you, Murdoch. You're laying here, a sad, broken man. You think you would have learned your lesson after the first truck, but you know, you always got to be Martyr Murdoch, throwing yourself in front of unstoppable forces. And that kind of describes the relationship you and I have pretty neatly, doesn't it? And your friend Daredevil, same thing, like two sides of a coin, Daredevil and Murdoch, always biting at my heel. Though according to the file, it would appear that your edge has been dulled. And Matt's thinking, of course he has my confidential medical file. He's a Kingpin. He gets whatever he wants. And Kingpin goes on to continue to gloat, because he's just that kind of guy, right? And Matt, as scared as he is, he starts to get angry. We see him kind of clench his fist and think about who the Kingpin really is. You know, you can dress him up all you want, silk shirt, cologne, you know, whatever, but he always has underneath him that that stink of blood under his fingernails. And that smell of sweat. And as Kingpin sits down and makes himself comfortable and looks out, I love a night like this. I always have ever since your friend joined us. And as he looks out the window, he sees that it's snowing. And he's like, yeah, it was a night like this. I decided I'd face down the devil. And he's thinking back to that night where he basically took on Daredevil. He set a trap for him. And he knew that Daredevil would be lured in by this trap, and he knew that snow was forecast. And he enjoys telling this story to Matt, because again, he's there to gloat. And he says, you know, it's a shame you're asleep, because I must tell you, speaking freely to you like this, it's a delight. It's positively Catholic, he says. You know, he's given his confession. He's admitting to, you know, things that he did wrong. And as Matt lays there pretending to be asleep, we see that yellow and red first Daredevil costume, that version of a demon or aspect of his personality or whatever it is. That's basically the embodiment of fear that seems to be haunting Matt, that he can't get rid of, sort of slither up around him and protect him. And it's imploring Matt, stay asleep, stay silent, pretend like you're sleeping. If he knew you were alive, he'd kill you. There would be nothing you could do. And we go back to the flashback, and we see, you know, these goons basically loading up the boxes in the back of Kingpin's limousine. And Daredevil wants to know what's in the boxes. He said, nothing, of course. I just wanted to be sure you'd come. You're not really one to answer typewritten invitations. And Daredevil's kind of taken aback. He's like, there are certain conditions that we've noticed where it's safe to operate without worrying about Daredevil. Don't you think that's kind of weird? And Matt's like, what do you mean? He's like, it's always been a puzzle. And I've been trying to solve that puzzle. Been trying to crack it. So this is my city. Why don't you look up? And when Matt looks up, he sees that snow is coming down. And obviously with his radar sense, that makes it very hard for him to get his bearings and to see anything, because his radar sense bounces off all the snowflakes. So then the scene shifts back and Daredevil is, Kingpin rather, is relaying this story, saying it was magnificent. Daredevil was helpless. And it was great. It was elemental and it was clean and it was pure. And I was getting my satisfaction. I can still feel it. Daredevil, the bane of my existence, just hammering on him. And the scene shifts back to the previous fight, you know, the flashback, and Kingpin's telling him, you know, there's something about the snow. For some reason, you don't operate in it. But then when you hear the Kingpin of Crime is personally going to take possession of some contraband, you knew that you had to be here. And I knew it was going to snow that night, but it was too good to pass up. It was too good of a chance to catch the Kingpin red-handed. Daredevil's losing the fight badly. When he manages to take the fight inside the limousine, he baits Kingpin to follow him. And once he's inside, then he's still not at a huge advantage because it's such a small space and Kingpin, you know, outweighs him and is bigger than him. But it allowed Daredevil to at least escape. And the Kingpin thinks, you know, even though I didn't beat him that day, I learned that weakness of his. And I'm going to keep finding his weaknesses and taking things from him and taking people from him until it's only the two of us left. And then I'll take him in these two hands and he will die. And if I wanted, I could take you from him too. And Matt, as he's laying there in his bed, is thinking, yeah, I'm tired, I'm scared, I'm in pain, and I just want it all to end. But most of all, what I feel listening to Kingpin gloat on and on and on, what I feel is anger. And as Kingpin reaches out towards Matt saying, I could kill you right here, Murdoch, murder in your bed, in your sleep, and nothing would happen to me. And Matt's eyes fly open. He says, go on then, do it. And the Kingpin is taken aback. His heart is pounding all of a sudden. He says, Murdoch? Like, he's just shocked, the look on Matt's face. And Matt sits up in bed and says, do it. Do it or get the hell out of my room. And Kingpin, he's real flustered. And he says, get well soon. And he walks out. And Matt's thinking to himself, you know what? I'm broken. I'm wrecked. I'm ruined. Worst of all, I'm afraid. But I'm not the only one. And that's something. Because no matter who the Kingpin thinks he is and what power the Kingpin thinks he has, there's something about Matt Murdock. There's something about Daredevil that gets to the Kingpin. And you almost get the feeling at the end of the story as Kingpin storms out that he almost was gloating. He almost was telling the story to try to convince himself that he wasn't carrying that fear around. But what's really great on the last page, as Kingpin is kind of walking out, head down, shoulders slumped, we see behind him the same sort of skeletal demon or ghost or whatever it is that embodies fear. You know, for Matt Murdock, for Daredevil, it's that skeleton-like demon with the red glowing eyes that wears his red and yellow original costume, right? That's the fear that constantly is that he feels looking over his shoulder, right? That's kind of the monkey on his back. Well, it turns out that the Kingpin has one of those too. And we see that on the last page, you know, same kind of skeletal looking demon with the red glowing eyes, dressed in a you know, Kingpin suit with the red jeweled tie pin, you know, hearkening back to his earliest appearances. The Kingpin fears too. So what he fears is Matt Murdock and Daredevil. So it's a good reminder of that. And as much as I don't like this series, and I've talked about that at length before, I think this one is actually the best issue, if only for that last page where it shows us that there is something inherent in Matt Murdock and something inherent in Daredevil. And Kingpin, of course, has forgotten that they're one and the same. But there's something inherent there that the Kingpin fears. And I think there's power in that. And it's good to be reminded of that from time to time. So, yeah, best issue of a not very good series. All right, next up we have Superior Spider-Man number 2. This one's written by Christos Gage. We have art by, or I should say pencils by Mike Hawthorne. Inks are by Wade Von Grobiger with Victor Olazaba. Colors are by Jordi Belair, and letters are by Clayton Cowles. So we know that Dr. Octopus basically took over Peter Parker's body for an extended period of time and operated as Spider-Man, even though the series was called the Superior Spider-Man. He pretended to be Spider-Man for a while. And then Superman came back, and Dr. Octopus actually did something sort of heroic, and he gave up Spider-Man's body to save the woman that he loved. And he took a new body, a new cloned body that had aspects of both Peter's DNA and his own, and took up the alias of Elliot Tolliver. And he's begun a new life as a professor in San Francisco at Horizon University. And he's was the Superior Octopus, but then decided that he wanted to have more of a clean break from his previous Dr. Octopus identity. And now he is the Superior Spider-Man. But in the first issue of the series, we saw that love of his, who also happens to work at Horizon University, Anna Maria Marconi, basically saw through his disguise and threatened to turn him in. But before she could, Terrax the Tamer showed up in San Francisco and started attacking. And so Anna Marie didn't really have a choice but to let Otto race off to try to save the city. So that's where this issue starts, with Terrax basically just destroying buildings and SWAT vans and yelling and screaming, saying, "I'm Terrax the Tamer, Herald of Galactus," or once Herald of Galactus, the World Devourer. You have two choices. You can bow to your new monarch, or you can die screaming. So apparently Terrax has come to Earth to rule it, I guess. We have a nice little character moment here where a couple of gentlemen, very elderly gentlemen who clearly are partners and have been in love for a long time. One is stuck under a car and says, "I'm stuck, you have to go." His partner replies, "I'm not going to leave you now. I'm too old and ugly to find a new husband. So one more try." And Paul, the one that's trapped, tells the other, Gene, "Get out of here while there's still time." But as they turn, Terrax is there. And he says, "You know, your beloved speaks truly, old one. His life is forfeit. But you know what? Terrax could be a benevolent king. So show me your obedience, and I'll let you live." And Gene's like, "You know what? We've been together for 40 years in spite of a lot worse than you standing in our way. You know, clearly fighting for equal rights, for same-sex marriage and all that sort of thing." And he says, "You know what? We live together, and if we die together, I'm okay with that." And Terrax just casually flicks him away with the barest motion of his hand. Says, "You want death? Great, no problem. Terrax will give it to you." But before he can do any worse, all of a sudden Superior Spider-Man is there, and he's basically used his extra arms to pick up a city bus, and he smashes it into Terrax. And then lifts the car off of Paul, who then grabs is pulled out from underneath by his partner, Gene. And they're asking, "Is the monster dead?" Well, of course not, because right at that moment, Terrax swings his axe at Spider-Man, and there's a pretty brutal fight that starts. So meanwhile, back at Horizon University, in the lab of Dr. Octopus, or Elliot Tolliver, we see Anna Marie she's watching the fight on TV, and she's trying to figure out what to do. It's like, "Man, that guy's Dr. Octopus, the guy that lied to me and manipulated me. And where are the Avengers? Shouldn't they be here? I mean, this is Terrax the Terrible. Like, he's, you know, former Herald of Galactus, super powerful." And the robot assistant of Dr. Octopus says, "Well, the Avengers, according to my information, are off world." Like, okay, well, even if we call Peter Parker, he can't get here in time. But who can we call? Captain Marvel, the X-Men, Deadpool. Like, well, we're unable to reach any of those people. And she's like, oh my God, what? Don't tell me the only thing standing between San Francisco and destruction is Otto freaking Octavius. So meanwhile, back at the fight, we see that Dr. Octopus, this happened in the first issue, and I didn't mention it when I was recapping things, but we did see in the first issue that he, Dr. Octopus had basically taken out the night shift, that team of supervillains. They were robbing a bank, and rather than turn them in, because that's not the way he does things, he basically blackmailed them into sort of being his information network, and sort of lieutenants, I guess you'd say, or minions, do his bidding, and he pay him a bunch of money and whatever, and say like, hey, I'll give you more money than you'll make robbing banks, and you're just gonna come and work for me. I don't want to say work for the good guys, because is he a good guy? Is he not? You know, that's up for debate. But anyway, he does show up, or they do, I should say, they do show up and help Otto in the fight, but it doesn't go well because, again, this is Terax the Tamer. This guy has the power cosmic, and it's not, I mean, as powerful as a superior Spider-Man is, it's not, you know, he doesn't rise to the level. Let's just put it that way. He doesn't rise to the level of Terax the Tamer. And at one point, Superior Spider-Man even picks up a busted electrical cable and channels through his arms all the power in the city electrical grid and tries to basically shock Terax. And he's like, Terax just kind of stands there smoldering after all this electricity has been, you know, directed at him. And he goes, are you done yet? Like, I possess the power cosmic. What do you think that little electricity is going to do to me? And he blasts Superior Spider-Man, and he goes flying back, and he's now he knows he's in trouble, right? He's got multiple broken ribs, second and third degree burns, and he's starting to realize that he might be overmatched. So back at the lab, one of his little drones is speaking, saying, Anna, are you still there? And Anna's like, wait, are you talking to me? Yep. It's basically Dr. Octopus talking through this drone. And Anna says, yeah, I'm watching this mess on TV. Don't think this changes anything. It says, no, that's not it. Listen, these drones, they're working on a means to combat Terax, but I don't know if I can last long enough in the fight for them to complete it. So I'm asking for the good of the city and all the people who live within it. Will you help them, you know, build this quicker? And as much as she doesn't like Dr. Octopus and for everything that she had to go through because of him, obviously she's not going to say no to that. You know, she doesn't want Terax to destroy the city. So she does help out and start fixing and helping to build this object, this doodad, this gadget, whatever it is that's supposed to stop Terax. But man, in the meantime, Superior Spider-Man is getting his butt kicked. He's bleeding. At one point he throws a grenade, an explosive device, right down Terax's throat. That doesn't stop him. And so he's really in big trouble. He gets to the point where he just feels like he just needs to keep moving. Like, don't even fight, ignore the pain, just stay out of reach, just keep moving. But unfortunately, Terax gets in one last kick, and Superior Spider-Man's barely able to stay on his feet and jump out of the way. And as he's laying there and Terax is about to land the killing blow, he hears a voice in his ear saying, Otto, listen, you can't give up now. It's ready. We're sending the device to you. That gives Otto the energy. Hearing Anna's voice gives Otto the energy to, and the fact that the device is done gives him the kind of the boost he needs to sort of keep running. And so, the night shift are able to go and grab the device, and Anna decides that she needs to go too. And whether this is for residual feelings of Otto or not, I guess we'll see in subsequent issues. That's not the reason she gives. She said, you know, take me with you. You might need me. I built that thing. And now Terax makes that classic villain mistake. He starts to gloat as Otto's barely able to even get on his feet. Terax is kind of toying with him, saying, you were a spirited foe, a small one to challenge me. And I'm sure that the Earthers have some sort of, you know, saying for such stupidity, But you've lost, you failed your city, and now it's time for both you and your city to die. And just as he's about to chop off, use his cosmic axe to chop off Dr. Octopus's head, he says, well, you know what, I think the metaphor you wanted was dumb as a rock, because Terax does look like he's made out of rock. And Terax is like, what? Like, he's kind of confused and kind of freezes for a moment. And right at that moment, they're able to drop the gadget that they built, which is basically like this collar. And it goes over his head. Basically, it goes over Terax's head. And there's a couple of levers on it. And Terax looks up to see the night shift are flying above him, and they've dropped this gadget on it. And that distraction is enough for Otto to basically turn on the device. He pulls the couple of levers, and Terax is like, well, what trickery? He goes, oh, it's a device Victor Von Doom has used a time or two. And basically, he used it to steal the Silver Surfer's powers, but I'm going to use it to drain yours. And yeah, he pulls the levers, and Terax is freaking out, saying, I'm not going to allow this. He goes flying off, sort of a kind of a suicide run, if you will, because he figures it's the one way he can get Superior Spider-Man off of his back, literally, right? Because he's flying toward this building. Superior Spider-Man's holding on to the handles on the gadget and riding him like a surfboard, for lack of a better term. So they go crashing into this building. The building falls down out of the wreckage. Terax rises, saying, a clever gambit, but too late. You've been crushed, Spider. But no, not really, because all of a sudden there's a big burst of energy, and the voice says, hardly. And we see Otto has been healed. Even his costume is fixed. And he says, things have changed, Terax. For now, you're facing the cosmic-powered Superior Spider-Man. So as powerful as Terax is, even without the power of cosmic, based on his just inherent attributes as an alien and what his race is able to do, can he stand up to a cosmic powered Dr. Octopus or cosmic powered Superior Spider-Man? Well, I guess we're going to find out next issue. In the final panel there, we get Anna Maria looking on, knowing that she just gave Dr. Octopus this huge amount of power, and she still sees him as a villain. So she's wondering, oh boy, please tell me I didn't just make a colossal mistake, you know, and they're going to end up having Dr. Octopus ruling the planet instead of Terax the Tamer. So the final outcome, we'll figure out next issue when we talk about Superior Spider-Man number 3. But for now, that's going to do it for this title. As far as the artwork goes, one of the things I don't like about the art is the coloring. I feel like when it's a Spider-Man book that's pretty classically superheroic, and I would expect to see bright colors. And this is Jordi Belair, who's one of the best colorists in comics. So again, you just expect to see bright colors, but this issue's got a ton of brown in it. When they're fighting in the city, like, everything's brown. All the buildings are brown, all the dust and the debris and the wreckage, everything is just brown. And even the Superior Spider-Man's costume, which you know, would expect to be the typical red and blue of Spider-Man, is somewhat muted. And Terax himself, I mean, he's a pretty colorful character. I mean, his body is gray, but his costume is, you know, red and yellow or gold, and this sort of dark blue, but not like a navy blue, not to that level of dark. So I wonder why Jordi chose to color it so dark. I don't know if that has to do with the fact that it's not Spider-Man, and it is Dr. Octopus. It is a Superior Spider-Man. It is a little bit more of a serious, I don't want to say a serious story, but he's, you know, he's not super heroic. I mean, he's trying his best, but there's still that aspect, that arrogance to his personality, that condescension. So yeah, I'm just not sure. But when it comes to Terax, you know, he's so cosmic, and having these muted colors, it doesn't feel cosmic, if that makes any sense. So it's a slight nitpick, and, you know, I don't love Jordi Belair's work any less for that. I just, you know, maybe it's a stylistic choice. I just kind of wonder about that. And you see it on the cover as well. If you look at the cover of this book, it's very much in that same sort of color palette where it's not bright. And I think a brighter cover would have made it pop and it would have been really cool looking, but it just ends up being okay, unfortunately. So yeah, maybe just a creative choice that I don't necessarily agree with, but who am I to say, right? I mean, they're making comics, best-selling comics. I'm not. So anyway, let's move on. As we always do on Marvel Mondays, we're going to be talking about an issue of the Charles Soule Daredevil run. This time we're going to be talking about issue number 19. As I said, written by Charles Soule. Art is by Mark Lamming. Colors are by Miroslav Merva and Matt Miller. And we have letters by Clayton Cowles. So a little bit different style in the art here as opposed to the normal Ron Garney style art. So we saw last issue that the Purple Man had showed up and had kidnapped a lot of his purple children to basically boost his power enough by putting them in this amplification machine. And it was going to allow him to rule the world. He was going to be able to basically broadcast his power so that he didn't have to be in the room with somebody or in close proximity with somebody to control them. So once the Purple Man was able to capture all his children, he was even able to take over Daredevil. And it's not looking good for our hero by the end of the last issue. Let's just put it that way. So this one starts off and we're in Zeb's bar. Zeb being Zebediah Kilgrave, the Purple Man. And this is basically the projection, if you will, that Purple Man is putting in Matt's mind, because we see Matt basically sitting at the bar of this Zeb's bar, whatever it is, sitting there. And he's looking at his glasses saying, "That's strange. I can see these. Should I be able to see these? Should I be able to see you? That seems strange to me. Like, why?" There's some level. Again, Matt has been brainwashed. He doesn't know who he is. And this is all being told, remember, in flashback. Matt is actually in a confessional in a church in San Francisco. If, you know, it's in the future, these are events that happened in the past when everybody still knew that Matt Murdock was Daredevil. And we know that genie had somehow been put back in the bottle. But for now, Matt has been talking about how he feels lost. He doesn't know who he is anymore because so many things have changed. He's not practicing law anymore. People know his secret identity, and he just feels like he doesn't know who he is. And so when he says, "This feels strange, that I shouldn't be able to see," right? And Zeb's like, "Well, strange, Matt Murdock, the attorney, this is Zeb's pal. Anything can happen here." And as he says that, and the scene sort of pulls back, we see all these other versions of Matt there. We see him in his earliest iteration in the red and yellow costume. We see him in his 90s armored costume. We see him in the costume that's inspired by the Daredevil TV show, where he just has a sort of a black handkerchief tied over his face. So all these different eras of Daredevil are represented, including the regular old Matt Murdock sitting at the bar. And he says, "Okay, but," and Zeb's like interrupts him saying, "You know what we can talk about? Let me tell you about this game I like to play with my customers. It's called The Worst Thing. Let's play. You want to play?" And Matt's like, "All right, I guess. What are the rules?" He says, "There's no rules. I hate rules. It's just a real simple question. What's the worst thing? Like the very worst possible thing you could ever see yourself doing." And Matt thinks about it for a little bit. He's like, I don't know. I guess I never really thought about that. And Zeb, a Purple Man, is like, "Well, why are you being so lazy? Think about it, right? I don't have all day for you to come up with something good." And Matt's sort of distracted by what he sees on the TV, and he sort of looks away and he's like, what's going on? And Zeb, no, don't worry about the television, man. Look at me, pay attention to me. Tell your friend, the Purple Man, what's the worst thing you could think of to ever do? And as he turns Matt's head toward him, we get a chance to see what's on the TV, and it says, "In total control of Daredevil." And it's basically a scene of what's happening in reality, right? And when we turn the page, we get a chance to see that ourselves, and it's the purple man holding Daredevil and imposing his will on him, saying, tell me, what is the worst thing that you would ever do, the thing you would like to die before you do it? And Daredevil saying, I don't know. I'd have to dig pretty deep because I don't usually think about things like that. Why do you want to know? And Purple Man says, well, you know, you might not believe this, but having this power to make people do whatever you want them to do, it's not always the blessing that it seems, because sometimes it gets boring, right? I've had people do terrible things, the worst things I could think of. But that only has its limits, right? Like you kill one person or force one murder suicide, and you've kind of done it all. So I don't make it about what I want anymore. I make it about what they don't want. Instead of doing, you know, forcing them to do the worst thing I can think of, I force them to do the worst thing they can think of. That one monstrous thing that their mind could think up that basically destroys them, right? I just watch their souls burn to ash. It's awesome. And man, you think about that, what the Purple Man is saying here, so this is like evil incarnate, man. This guy is bad news all around. I mean, he's not depraved and psychotic enough, you know, that he's in imposing his will on other people. Now he's taking it up to another level and asking them, what's the most evil thing you can think of? And then turn around and making them do that. It's horrible. But this is everything the Purple Man's ever wanted. Like he's wanted it for a long time, right? Like normally Daredevil's way too strong-willed for the Purple Man to impose his will upon Daredevil. But with the added power of his kids, the purple children inside this device, it's given him this chance to sort of override, or at least he thinks it's given him this chance to override that incredible strong will that Daredevil normally has. So he's like, I'm either going to burn down the world or I'm going to own it, or maybe both. I'm still deciding. But in the meantime, I can't miss my chance to play with you first. So dig deep, man. Tell me your darkest thoughts. What's the worst thing? And the scene shifts back to the bar, and that very first iteration of Daredevil that's been retconned in, the one that's inspired by the TV show, where he's just wearing the black mask or handkerchief or hood or what have you. It's like, worst thing I can tell you, it's failing. It's failing the people you love. Think about them laying in the gutter dead because you didn't do enough. You know, that's the worst thing. The fact that, you know, you're responsible for that, that you didn't help defend people who can't defend themselves. And you know the exact moment that their hearts stop. And another one of the versions of Daredevil, sort of the debonair Matt Murdock wearing the red suit and the red tie, says, easy, friend. We're all just trying to have a good time here. Why don't you go back over there and I'll buy you a drink. Stop talking this crazy talk. And the black hooded version says, who are you supposed to be? Oh, you know, I'm Daredevil. And they get up and they kind of face off against each other, and before they know it, they're fighting. Purple Man says, wow, this show's getting kind of dark. Why don't we sort of change the scenery here? Let's go take a visit to your girlfriend. And as the scene shifts, we're now in their apartment, and Kirsten wants to know what Daredevil's doing with the Purple Man, and Purple says, be patient, Kirsten, the girlfriend. I don't want to spoil a surprise. And Daredevil's like, what, you're going to make me killer? That's pretty small, man. I've lost plenty of girlfriends before, and that'd be pretty terrible, but been there, done that. I can do better or worse, as the case is. And Purple Man's like, are you sure? Because this seems all right to me. It's like, well, if you want the worst thing, I've got to go bigger. I was like, okay, friend, then let's go. And Kirsten's just super confused in the background, like, Matt, what are you doing? So meanwhile, back at the bar, the scene shifts back to the bar, and we still see the red three-piece suit Matt fighting the black clad original Daredevil Matt, and Zeb saying, all right, I'm trusting you, what do you got here? And so he's thinking back, and all of a sudden Daredevil in the original costume, right, the yellow and red costume, comes up to him and says, you know, you're making this too complicated, keep it simple, get back to your roots. And as the scene shifts back to the warehouse, Porkman wants to know, why are you just standing there? He says, no, I'm not just standing here. I'm listening. Four blocks away, there's a guy getting mugged in an alley. Some kids are about to throw a cinder block into traffic. There's a jumper on the bridge, and she's about to jump because any second because her heart rate just spiked. And this original version, this yellow and red clad daredevil, is about to say, you know, for him, what is the worst? When all of a sudden the 90s daredevil comes up and smacks him across the face with a billy club and says, you're wrong, idiot. You're not thinking big enough. The worst thing needs to be extreme. And of course, this is the 90s costume daredevil, right? With the metal shoulder pads and, you know, all the black on the costume and bracelets and all that. And 90s were extreme, right? So the yellow and red clad daredevil has recovered and he tackles him saying extreme. Now that's idiotic. And now they're fighting. So Matt basically has all these different eras of himself fighting against each other. In the background, as he's still talking to the purple man, he's like, you know what? You might be right. I do need to think big. And the purple man's like, okay, now that's what I want to hear. I like the sound of that. And as the scene shifts back to the warehouse, he says, okay, your machine can control everybody in the world at once, right? He says, yeah, exactly. That's the whole point. So could you hurry this up? Because I've got plans. And Daredevil says, okay, here's what I want then. Chaos. And the purple man's like, okay, that's one of my favorite words. I can make that happen. Coming right up. And does a little few adjustments on his machine. He says, okay, off we go. And there's a big bright flash that envelops him and then, you know, comes out of the machine, this bright, blinding, white, purplish light. And in that moment, all across the world, people just start fighting each other. And in the background now, we even see in the bar that there are more versions of Matt and more versions of other past people that Matt knows. Everybody in the bar is basically brawling except him. He's just sitting at the bar. And we even see heroes, Spider-Man, Hulk, Falcon, Iron Man, Thor, they're all fighting amongst themselves as well. And Purple Man says, okay, you got what you wanted. There's chaos everywhere. It's exactly what you wanted. So what's next? And Daredevil's like, nothing. And Purple Man's like, wait, what do you mean nothing? Matt's like, yeah, this is the worst thing. I can hear it. There's chaos. The entire world's gone crazy. That's the worst thing. Knowing that I have the ability to help while the whole world goes crazy, and I'm going to sit here and do nothing. And that sort of awakens or grabs the attention of all the different Matt Murdocks, all the different versions of Daredevil that he's been over the years. He remembers who he is, basically. It's like, yeah, the world is going to hell. I know about it. I have the power to help and I do nothing. And the purple man's pissed. He's like, what? And all the different versions of Daredevil all ask, who are you? And I think they're all asking that of this version, this true Matt Murdock. All the different versions, all the different iterations from all the different writers throughout the years that have made stories and created stories about Daredevil, including the Netflix show, they're all contributing to this one perfect, pure person who is Matt Murdock. Not to say he doesn't make mistakes, not to say he's not human, but all these different aspects of himself come back together. He's talking about how he was lost and he's found himself again. And as the narrative sort of shifts and we start getting these dialogue boxes, which is Matt continuing his confession to the priest, it kind of explains what happened here. He says, Kilgrave asked me about the worst thing I could ever possibly do. And I couldn't answer that question at first, right? Like all these different aspects of my personality were coming around, giving me their ideas of what they thought the worst thing would have been for me at any particular time. But it's not as easy a question as you might think, because you have to know yourself in order to know what the worst thing you do is, right? If it's something that's not just bad or a mistake, it's something irredeemable, you're crossing that line and taking that step into the darkness, and the door closes and it locks behind you forever. How can you know yourself that well? How can you know what the thing is that is the complete opposite and antithesis of who you are? You have to know who you are first, right? You have to know exactly who you are in order to say, here's the exact opposite of me. He says, yeah, I couldn't answer that question at first because I didn't know who I was, because I was lost. And it's great. While he's saying this, while we're getting the boxes on the pages, the exposition box that are telling this, we see in the warehouse, Purple Man's just pissed. Like, I wasted all that time and effort. Man, I'm going to make you eat your best friend. I'm going to make you step on a puppy. I'm going to make you... And before he can finish the sentence, Daredevil's basically broken his hold on him. And we get Matt saying, I was lost, but then I was found. And Daredevil just jumps up, grabs the Purple Man by the back of the head, and slams his face into the machine. And Purple Man's yelling, no, stop, stop, can't you hear me? And Daredevil says, yeah, I had to piece together a lot of what happened, but this part I remember. I remember that moment of release when I came back to myself and I realized everything that Kilgrave had done and everything he was going to do. I might have taken it a bit too far. You know, I might have beaten on him a little bit, but I didn't kill him. Could have been worse. But it's just such a great scene, and it's such a great narrative device because it makes so much sense, right? I mean, so many times you have a story like this where some villain is uber powerful, like Purple Man, and clearly Daredevil is under his spell, under his complete control. And then something happens, and it's usually some sort of ex deus machina reason, you know, like, oh, there's a delivery at the door that distracts the villain, or the villain is distracted by giving their Bond villain monologue that somehow allows the hero to whatever, right? There's some sort of outside force that happens, some sort of outside event that allows just that little bit they need, that the hero needs to sort of escape or to, you know, turn the tables on the villain. But what's so great about this, what Charles does here, is that this is all coming from within, and it makes perfect sense. Purple Man does it to himself, you know. He wants to know what the worst thing that Daredevil can do is, and it makes so much sense that you would not know that. You will not know what 180 degree opposite of your goodness is, you know, what that terrible thing is, unless you know who you are. So I just thought it was so great. Like, when this happened, I'm like, oh yeah, that is such a great way to have Daredevil overcome this, and it's very in keeping with who Matt Murdock is. So back in the confessional, the priest is asking, well, did you kill him? He said, no, I didn't kill him. I don't kill. And the Purple Man can heal from everything. And I knew he was going to heal from this, maybe not anytime soon. And the priest said, but did everything really happen? Because I don't remember that happening. And I feel like I would have remembered the world going insane, even if it was only for a little bit. Was any of that real? And Matt says, I didn't know for sure, not then. I knew that everything had gone quiet in the city. And, you know, he got the purple children out of the chambers of the machine and, you know, made sure that they were all going to be all right. After he freed them, he said, yeah, we're okay, but where are you going? He said, well, I got to go help Kirsten, right? I got to get out there. I got to do something. I have to help. I mean, here he just wished for all the world to be in chaos, and he's... Again, it's completely antithetical to who he is. So the first thing he's going to do is just get out there. Is the world okay? Let me check on the woman that I love. Let me check on the city. Let me check on the people. You know, everything's quiet out there, but maybe it's too quiet. And, you know, I don't think that we really went to visit her. And you know, the insinuation being Purple Man was going to have Matt kill Kirsten. But he needs to make sure that she's okay and that the city's okay and that nothing that he wished for, nothing that he relayed to the Purple Man has caused, you know, long-lasting damage. So as he swings away, the children are looking on going, man, that poor guy, we wish we should do something for him. And we get the to be continued. So again, it this sort of writing and this sort of narrative, this perfect pacing is exactly why this is like my favorite run of Daredevil, because we're getting these ideas and we're getting these events that are happening that they're not 100% original, right? It's not like we've never seen the or heard of the idea before of a villain forcing a hero to do the worst thing they could do. And it's almost the fact that that is sort of a cliche or can be considered a cliche that makes this work so well, right? Like we expect villains to do that sort of thing when they have a hero at their mercy, right? And it's not just in hero comics either. I mean, we've seen the story time and time again. What's immediately popping into my head is Point Break, right? With Keanu Reeves and, oh my God, Patrick Swayze, almost forgot his name for a second there. And Keanu Reeves, you know, he's an FBI guy, but he's forced to go on this and rob this bank with these guys because his girlfriend, the woman he loves, has been kidnapped, you know, under duress. And we've seen that in hundreds of TVs and movie shows and novels and comics and whatever, you know, where somebody is forced to do something they don't want to do, something that's complete opposite of them, you know, their normal nature, because they're under somebody else's spell or control or duress or what have you. But the fact that Charles takes that idea that's been, you know, used time and time again and flips it on its head and actually uses that to be the thing that is the impetus for Daredevil overcoming the control, right? By trying to figure out what the worst thing is, he has to know himself. And once he knows himself, he's no longer lost. He no longer is consumed with all the self-doubt about if he's doing the right thing because he's not out there, you know, fighting enough crime because people know he's Daredevil and it might come back on him or come back on the DA or ruin the case against the criminal, or it might come back on Kirsten at one point. Like all those doubts that have come along with the consequences of people knowing his secret identity, all those fade away in that moment when he remembers who he is. And he's a person that if the world were in chaos and he has the power to help, he's going to help. So again, I just think it's really, really great writing, and I highly recommend it. I think this purple story, the purple story arc is probably my favorite of the entire Charles Soule run. It's just, it's so perfectly, if I can talk, so perfectly encapsulates who Matt Murdock is. And it's just a great, clever writing. So anyway, I think that's going to do it for this episode. I want to thank you all for listening as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.